You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 248 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, episode 248, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
Oh, the Seahawks. They got some things happening. We're going to get to that. We got a lot to get to. Has unexpectedly become typical in the month of February. Not really the hotbed of Seattle sports usually, but a lot to get to. So let's start with our beer this week, which is from our friends at Stoop Brewing, the Mixtape Romeo Dry Hopped Pilsner. Their description: in the entire history of humankind, there has never been a more profound expression of love than the personalized mixtape. Hours of deliberation about which songs to share from your home tape collection, followed by hours of tiny handwritten playlists with tiny hearts incorporated wherever possible. Follow that with play, record, change tape, play, record, change tape. This beer is our mixtape for you. First, we brewed the beer with Pilsner malt for a light body and gentle malt sweetness. Then we lagered the beer for several weeks to create a clean, refreshing crispness. Is our mixtape final song, we dry hopped with Mandarina Bavaria and Belma for aromas of tangerine and strawberries. Load it up, press play, and enjoy.
There we go. I didn't know that the term lagered was an adjective.
for drinking a lot of beer, the Fabulous Pelton brothers know nothing about the actual beer making process.
Don't know, don't want to know. But in the most Jan move possible, I think I hid this beer somewhere to let me know that it was reserved for podcasting and cannot find it. This is just like the 1995 NCAA tournament all over again.
Well, hopefully you find that Madden 96 game soon. No, I know that one's been recovered because Baby Fantasy Genius likes to play it on the Super Nintendo.
Yes.
Okay, several toasts this week, starting with Seahawks quarterback Russell Wilson named NFL Walter Payton
Year. Seahawks?
Oh, hell. Well, Wilson joins Steve Largent as the second Seahawks player to win the honor, which has been awarded since 1970, rewarding excellence on the field and community service off it. I really wrote that note poorly, as it turns out. So
yeah.
Congrats to Russ.
Yeah, congrats to Russ. He really followed up that Walter Payton Man of the Year honors by having himself a Monday and Tuesday.
He sure did. Part of the reason he was on the Dan Patrick show, as we'll get to later, is because on Tuesday, GQ unveiled their March issue covers as part of the Modern Lovers issue, two of three of which feature Seattle athletes. Of course, you've got Russell Wilson and Sierra, plus Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe, Seattle's power couples. The third couple is Naomi Osaka and the rapper Corday. An excellent GQ feature out Tuesday on Bird and Rapinoe by Emma Carmichael discussed the backstory on their engagement and notably said that Bird is, quote, interested in team investment and ownership, particularly with the women-owned Storm in the possible resurrection of the NBA's Supersonics.
Wow. There we go.
Let's get Sue involved.
Once again, Jonathan Richman snubbed for the GQ March Modern Lovers Edition.
Next up, Crystal Langhorne announced her retirement after a 13-season WNBA career, the last seven with the Storm. Two-time All-Star, both with the Washington Mystics, Langhorne was a part of the Storm's last two championship teams. She, in conjunction with retiring, is simultaneously joining the Storm front office to serve as director of community engagement for the team's Force for Change social justice initiative created last summer. So cool to see her transition to that role. As I mentioned on Twitter, Storm previously did that with Noelle Quinn when she retired after their first championship and joined their coaching staff. So, you know, really kind of bridging the player front office and player management relationships. That's cool. We also got news Tuesday that a former Storm player, Renee Montgomery, is retiring after 11 seasons in the WNBA.
Montgomery played the first half of the 2015 season in Seattle as a backup to Sue Bird. She sat out 2020 in the wobble to focus on social justice and has become an influential voice and an in-demand broadcaster. I actually had the privilege of working with Renee Montgomery when I did sideline for the G League Showcase.
There's your name drop.
2019. Yeah, there it is. I dropped that name.
You're like, yeah, TV experience.
It's definitely a stronger memory for me working with Renee Montgomery than the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Look, you and Mina Kimes, or Mina Kimes isn't the only Pelton brother with TV experience.
That is true. That is true. By the way, I should highlight third Pelton brothers getting together, Natalie Weiner interviewing Mina Kimes. What an amazing thing that was. Did you not see this when I
interviewing
it from
Mina
the Pelton
Kimes?
Camp? Yeah. She did an interview with Mina.
Okay.
So that was a fun read. Should we get into our search for Seattle's best fried chicken? We had a change of plans this week. We talked about going to Trey's Lake Route Eatery, but instead ended up going to Nana's Southern Kitchen in Kent because you wanted to go to someplace near you.
This was for convenience, but also I was just excited to eat Nana's Southern Kitchen. It was something that from the first moment that I heard about them, I was like, I want to get here as fast as possible.
Yeah, definitely. The first time I heard about it, this was a rare thing that Jan brought to my attention. Because she had read a story about how Nana's partnered with Jamal Crawford and three Microsoft executives to hand out 400 free meals on Christmas Day, and asked if we had heard of it. And I hadn't, and immediately checked it out, and took a little bit, but we got there and that was very exciting. Nana's opened in late 2019, and their description of it, Nana's Southern Kitchen started as a dream of the Miner family. Despite living on separate coasts, they eventually got everyone together to make it happen. Four generations of the Miner family now live in Kent to support and share their family recipes with the community. Nana's is named after co-owner Todd Miner's great-grandmother Myrtle Henderson, who was born in Goshen, Virginia, and later moved to New Haven, Connecticut. As a mother and grandmother, Myrtle cooked and served family and friends the same Southern foods you can enjoy today in the restaurant. So, if these are the same things that Nana was cooking, then it must have been delicious.
Well, yeah. I mean, anytime that food is being prepared by somebody named Nana, you're going to want to eat that food. But open in 2019, I was under the impression that this location, and I guess after going to it and seeing the building itself, I shouldn't have been surprised that it was open recently, but I was under the impression that it had been around for decades, right? It kind of has
that
feel
like,
to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see it and you're like, oh yeah, Nana's been at this for years, right?
Again, Nana is not involved. Nana is no longer with us.
No, it's kind of an incredible thing how something so new can feel like it has so much history to it though. And, you know, I had this whole diatribe prepared to be like, you know what's amazing? Is Nana's been out there doing this for 40 years and has no interest in franchising, no interest in expanding. It's just the one location. And to me, I feel like that's a lost art. But then I see this in the open in 2019, late 2019 also. I'm like, oh, okay. I'm sure that Nana's probably would expand if they could.
I think they it's definitely a possibility for down the road.
So I take back that. I mean, I still agree with that perspective of I really appreciate a place having one location and doing something very well and not being too concerned with the idea of getting as big as possible. And I think that ultimate leads to the best food that you can make. And with Nana's, I think it's a really special place because this is not a diverse menu in a lot of ways. You look at it and it's just like chicken, catfish, shrimp, pork. There's no types of chicken. It's just, do you want chicken? Here's the chicken. And I think that that's kind of a special thing. It's just like, there's one way that we prepare chicken and that's it. There's no substitutions. There's no coming in there and making it your way. You're getting chicken or you're getting pork or you're getting catfish or you're getting shrimp. And all of those items are prepared almost the exact same way.
Yeah, they're all going to be fried. That's the style. Yes. A kind of a light fry, which apparently is the Virginia style. I don't know if I eating a lot of
light
food specifically.
Fry is the Virginia style. Man, we're out here learning things.
Indeed we are.
Wow.
I got to say, when I first went to go look at the Nana's website, I was less excited about the main courses and more excited about the sides, which is perhaps a little unfortunate for a fried chicken search. But the photo of the candied yams in particular on here just looks delicious. And I would say that for sure lived up to the hype.
Absolutely.
I went with candied yams and mac and cheese as my two sides. Is that what you went with as well?
The yams with extra syrup. So good. Like there really is. Look, this is a search for Seattle's best chicken, and the chicken I thought was excellent. The yams won the day.
Oh, for sure. Without question. The mac and cheese was very good too.
And this is no offense to any other part of the meal. It's just those yams. The idea that this is a side and not a dessert is just like, thank the Lord for the times that we live in.
But you're getting your vegetables there. Like, you're eating healthy with those candied yams. I mean, candied yams have always been my favorite part of the Thanksgiving, or at least very high in my Thanksgiving power rankings. So to be able to get them on just a regular occasion was delightful. And it's different than the candied yams I'm used to, because you talk a lot about the sweet potato shake that Chef Eduardo Jordan did as part of his collaboration with Dick's, and how spicy it was and the different flavors. And that's how these candied yams were as well.
Oh my God. Look, we're actually just doing a search for Seattle's best yams now.
That may not be a very long search. We may be able to just call this one.
Okay, so what about the chicken though? Because the chicken is prepared in its full wings all the way down to the tip. There's that light fry like you were talking about. And again, that's it.
James, yeah, that was a little surprising.
Jane was on the phone with me beforehand and she's like, can I just get a chicken breast? And it was like, no, that's not what there is here. There are chicken wings and you don't get to pick and choose what you're getting. You're getting chicken or you're getting catfish or you're getting pork or you're getting shrimp. That's it, Jan. That you can't walk in there like it's fucking Popeyes and get one chicken breast walking down the Las Vegas Strip. You're getting chicken.
After going so far to the boneless chicken, fried chicken end of the spectrum for our first two restaurants that we reviewed in our search for Seattle's best fried chicken, we went to like the other extreme, because I feel like pure chicken wings are the other extreme where they're also considered potentially not fried chicken. But I do think this is eligible because these are not prepared like chicken wings. They're not sauced at all. They are prepared as if, you know, the drumstick portion of fried chicken, basically.
They are fried chicken wings.
So, which is not a thing I'd had before. And as you said, it wasn't the standout of the show, but it was definitely a good part of the meal nonetheless.
I think you might have eaten the chicken a little bit too late, because I got the package and immediately ate the chicken, right? It was still greasy in my hands. And I think the two things that stood out to me.
That was not an issue on my end.
The grease. Yeah. The things that stood out to me were that light fry, because I had no idea what to expect going into this, right? And it has a unique flavor to it. You know, it's almost like you can taste the fried more than you normally can, right? It doesn't taste like breading. You can taste the spices in it in a really nice way. And also the chicken in the wings was cooked perfectly. So I feel like, I mean, obviously of the bone-in chicken that we've had, there's no competitor, right? Like this destroyed the chicken that we had last week.
Without question.
You know, I forgot to have the sauce. It did come with a buffalo dipping sauce. I don't know if you use that.
I did.
I was so busy just eating the chicken wings that I didn't even get to the sauce. But I mean, I ate it with glee the entire meal. And then I came home, sat down, and did a bowl of half macaroni and cheese and half yams. And it was just like, all right, this is it. This is the life.
Which, by the way, I think that maybe the best thing was like
the syrup from the candied yams congealing with some of the cheese from the mac and cheese, and just eating those like scraping those last bits off my plate. This was like a literal, like, I was going to lick my plate clean situation.
Candied yams, mac and cheese is a thing now.
It's going to be a thing. I mean, I did heat up my plate once I got it. So I don't think it looked like lack of heat was an issue in any sense.
But still, you ate the food more than an hour after it was picked up.
Correct. It definitely was not the freshest food that I'm going to have in the search. Usually it's you that has the food much, much less fresh after Kevin Eats goes and gets it.
Yes.
Do you want to go for a rating here?
Purely on the chicken.
Right.
I think it's an 83.
I was an 80 purely on the chicken. But, I mean, the other thing is, like, looking at that menu outside of the context of the fried chicken search, I don't think the chicken is what I would get there.
Really?
I think I'd be intrigued to try the catfish. Mm-hmm. And I think the pork chops as well. I would want to try both of those for sure.
The shrimp didn't interest you.
The shrimp looked good, but I've done fried shrimp. I've not in my life eaten enough catfish, probably, and have not been eating enough soul food in my life historically.
Being from Seattle, Washington, you're not eating enough soul food?
Weirdly. I mean, look, Catfish Corner was going strong I think it still exists, does it? But a fried pork chop, definitely I've never tried. So I'm curious to find out what that's like. And then mostly I would just go back and load up on the sides because, again, they were amazing. The cornbread was also solid. So,
oh,
like,
my God. Everything that we ate just reminded me of how bad the previous meal was. Went back and gave the meal that we had a week ago a lower rating. Thinking about that fucking rock hard biscuit where I'm biting into it being like, you know, I don't need all my teeth. And then coming back and having this cornbread. Like, it's not, I've made cornbread. It's not easy to make cornbread that is like that. Like,
I'm sorry, did you just compare your making cornbread to?
I'm just saying,
to Nana?
Cornbread can get dry very easily.
That's true, yes.
And this cornbread was not dry at all. I kind of forgot about the cornbread. It was just like every item, you took it and you looked back a week and you're like, wow, that thing that I ate last week was horseshit compared to what I'm eating right now. The chicken and the sides and the cornbread versus the biscuit, they are just no competition whatsoever for literally a third of the price.
I mean, obviously there was a lot more food that came in there. I think the total cost was probably pretty similar. But yes, I mean, definitely. You got way more bang for your buck here. I cannot recommend trying Nana's highly enough if you haven't.
Plus, having just an item called dessert with no description of what it is such a power move of just being like, do you want dessert? There's no like types of dessert or anything. It's just whatever dessert is going to be that day. That is the fucking move right there.
Yeah. So next week, I think again, Dre's will be delayed because we want to try to get this in soon because I don't know if you've seen the forecast. We could be snowed in for an extended period of time here. It made me think back to the last time it snowed not long after the Super Bowl. In this case, that case, I think it was right after the Super Bowl.
It's the day which of was, the Super Bowl, yeah.
Which was 22 years ago, 2019. Mm-hmm. And it made me realize.
It was the last time that a team didn't score a touchdown in the Super Bowl.
Wow. Wow, it's been so long. Go all the way back. It made me realize that I was able to escape the snow while you were still snowed in out in the deep burbs to go to Charleston.
Oh my God. This was when you went to Charleston?
What I would give to be alone in Charleston right now.
Wow. Fucker. I might have to, after eating that fried chicken, I might have to revise my statement to wanting to be alone in Virginia. But nothing really can compare to alone in Charleston. I can't believe that was 2 years ago because I was saying to my various children today.
10 to 15.
Yeah, I was singing my Alone in Charleston song. And I was like, it's the name of my autobiography, the name of my first album, right? The name of my first fiction, the name of my most successful TikTok video. Like, Alone in Charleston is everything. It is a lifestyle.
It certainly is a lifestyle.
Certainly is a life stem.
God, I was getting pretty deep on the lyrics there too.
It's
kind of fantasizing.
Don't think I want to know.
If there's ever a time when I've wanted to be alone in Charleston, This is the moment.
Oh man.
Charleston.
Well, we can't travel to Charleston to eat right now safely, but we can travel to Little Woody's for Seattle Burger Month. Oh, I didn't say it, by the way. Next week, where we are going, which is the plan, is to go to Fat's Chicken and Waffles.
There we go.
Next week. So I'm excited for that.
Hell yes.
As I was saying, though, we can travel to Little Woody's.
Chicken and waffles, right?
Obviously. I mean, okay. Actually, the only way that you can get anything besides legs there is that to get the chicken and waffle, as far as I can tell, at least for the lunch menu.
And the chicken with the waffle is a strip?
No, it's either a breast or a thigh.
Are they boneless?
No.
Okay. There we go.
Yeah.
This bones 3 weeks in a row, people.
Look.
Have some respect. We eat the bones. On the Pelton Cast, we eat the bones.
Sometimes. As I was saying, Lil Woody's Seattle Burger Month continues this week with the Cochi Loco Burger from Ricardo Valdez of Raiz. That name translates to crazy pig because it's a chorizo patty with a lot going on here. Salsa matcha aioli, escabeche, queso Oaxaca, avocado slices, and topped with a bacon-wrapped jalapeno popper filled with cilantro cream cheese.
Oh my God, cilantro cream cheese.
Now, you did not avail yourself of this because of the fact that you do not eat chorizo. You have nothing to say about this?
What? I know that the people are going to be mad at it.
I mean, it doesn't agree with you. It happens sometimes,
you know.
But what I'm going to tell you is, you missed out because this is up there with my favorite Lil Woody's burger ever.
Wow,
it's that good. I mean, just the variety of different flavors in there, and then particularly like the layering of the Oaxaca cheese with the cream cheese in the jalapeno popper, like it was decadent.
Was it hot at all? Was this a one Modelo burger or a zero Modelo burger?
I don't think it was quite on the Modelo scale. I was going to say un
poquito. Then it's a zero Modelo burger. Everything is all on the Modelo scale.
I mean, I drank a Modelo while I was eating this.
Did you really?
Lil Woody's is offering Modelos. So yeah, I mean.
Lil Woody's has Modelos right now?
They do.
It's one Modelo burger then.
But I didn't need to go to the Modelo to cool the spice necessarily. So the pickled vegetables, the escabeche had some kick to them. And then obviously the jalapeno did as well. But the other bites weren't necessarily super spicy. Just like I said, a variety of flavor. I mean, there's so much going on. Like, you've already got all these cheeses. You don't really need bacon and avocado on there. But you know what? Go big or go home.
Yes.
That's what Ricardo Valdez apparently said.
Go big or go home. What if when we were making the Pelton Cast burger for Louis, we would have been like, okay, it's this, it's this, it's this. And then long dramatic pause. And a bacon-wrapped jalapeno popper filled with cilantro cream cheese.
I don't feel like we could have gotten away with that.
They would have said
professional
no.
Chefs.
Only Ricardo Valdez gets away with that.
I actually happened to go look through those emails earlier today, for believe it or not.
Did you?
That suggestion
did not come up. We got away with Lil Woody's having Rainier Tallboys in the location for the first time ever. So
outstanding. Toast to that. Even though it's not a Rainier Tallboy.
Toast to us.
Ricardo Valdez previously opened El Xolo to serve tacos at Nacho Bracho on Capitol Hill, and then opened Raiz at the end of 2019, serving Mexican food with local Northwest flavors. So
these were the Nacho Bracho tacos.
Subsequent to them being the Monica Dimas.
Monica Dimas.
Yeah. Which is now Little Neon Taco, which is now its own location. Little Neon Taco was there first and then moved out when they got their own location.
Okay, I was going to say, I haven't been to Nacho Bracho for a very long time. Even longer than not having been anywhere
right.
for a very long time.
I was going to say. So,
Anyways, definitely give that, again, a high recommend, strong recommendation to try it later this week. If we're not completely snowed in through next Monday, I might even consider getting a second one.
Wow. God, should I just eat chorizo? Should I eat chorizo for this?
I would consider it. I mean,
how similar is chorizo to sausage?
I mean, it's a type of sausage. So
I can eat bratwurst.
I mean, you would know more about your ability to eat chorizo than I would.
I don't know if I've ever had chorizo in my entire life.
You must have at some point. Right?
I don't think I have. I think I've always avoided chorizo because I felt like it was a type of sausage.
Well, you did feel that accurately, so that's fair.
The first time. Man, all right, if you go back, I will get one.
There it is.
Fuck it.
There it is.
The socks aren't going to earn themselves.
The other night, because we lost the cards. They asked me whether I had them. I was like, nope.
Did they remember you for the previous week?
No, they didn't remember me. I think they're asking everyone who got the special cards.
Marcus was there the first time that you went, right?
That was the week before, technically.
Oh, okay.
Burger Month. That was when they were doing the good old burger to prepare for Burger Month.
Okay.
So there you go. But I am always there, like Tuesday, as soon as I can put in an order, as soon as they start that new special, I am going to be there. Should we turn our attention to sports?
Absolutely, we should.
Let's start with It's Back, the NBA Seattle update, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. Because Pagliacci should be looking at a Soto option. And so should we.
A Soto option?
Yeah, I feel like there could be a location there somewhere. I don't know.
There definitely should be a location there. Well, and I'm going to put in the same plea. Did I already make this plea to Pagliacci? Lil Woody's, Pagliacci, whoever the fuck it is, downtown Renton. What are you doing? Why are you not in downtown Renton right now? Honestly, it's offensive that neither of those locations are there, that I would have to drive to White Center, all the way to White Center, literally the farthest place on earth from Fairwood, Washington.
West Seattle is the farthest place.
Ballard is actually the farthest place.
Oh, wow.
But there are no 2 points on the map. It would be faster to drive the opposite direction to get to Ballard. But
it's deep, like the drive from Renton to Shoreline.
The Renton to Shoreline is not actually that deep of a drive. It's just Ballard, you have to go a long way from freeways to get to. And Fairwood, Washington, you have to go a long way from freeways to get to.
Fair.
So if you like suburban driving, but you know where you don't have to go a long way from freeways to get to, that's downtown Renton, Washington. And that's where Lil Woody's and Pagliacci should be. This is the wave of the future, people. Move in right now.
There is a Macrina in Soto, so they've got some investment there.
You're just back to Soto. You're like, so anyways.
I'm moving on, yeah. Because we're talking about Soto, we're talking about prospective Seattle arena investor Chris Hansen, who joined the third Pelton brother, Mitch Levy, on Monday's episode.
No, he's not a third Pelton brother.
If you're only on Talk and Taco Time, you're not a third Pelton brother?
He's a fifth Talk and Taco Time host.
Oh, there he is, yes.
He's never been on the Pelton cast.
It is true. On Monday's episode of Mitch Unfiltered, for his first public comments.
That's the name,
NBA.
By the way, that's the name for every guest on Talkin' Taco Time, the fifth host.
He's the most of the fifth host, though. He definitely feels like it was discussed on Twitter last week, I think, when Third Felton brother Nate Taggart mentioned listening to the pod. Anyways, it's an extended interview between Chris Hansen and Mitch Levy, nearly 40 minutes, worth hearing in its entirety, but let's discuss a few highlights, starting with this clip.
If the NBA thinks that Key Arena is an adequate home, and I don't just mean in terms of the quality of the building, but the quality of the economics for the owners or potential bidders, then yeah, of course, we will 100% support it. And, you know, again, I'll be sitting courtside in Key Arena with our, you know, my seats and my friends and cheering on the Sonics. I think the important part of this is that it may not be that simple in that, you know, the trend, as we pointed out, has been towards teams in the NBA because of how much economics have improved to being in NBA-only buildings. And you can look at the recent evidence of that, including our old partner, Steve Ballmer, building his own building down in LA. And I think there's a pretty good chance that, you know, there will be ownership groups, including ours and including some outside of Seattle. This is really important too, that are going to be bidding with the assumption of building an NBA only arena.
So, I mean, his big message repeated throughout this was the important thing is to get the NBA back in Seattle, and that, you know, Chris Hansen and his group want to present an alternative in terms of that, as they mentioned, NBA only arena in SoTo, if the Climate Pledge Arena option isn't the best option for the NBA or for whatever ownership group, possibly theirs, is put together.
I think that totally makes sense. We'd sort of talked about that as it felt like the NBA, there were some questions that remained around Climate Pledge Arena, and having options is going to be the most important thing for bringing basketball back to Seattle, so that we're not locked into a situation where it is Climate Pledge Arena or nothing, right? Or if they can't make it work at Climate Pledge Arena, if for some reason the NBA confidently says they cannot have basketball in that arena, I'm pretty skeptical whether that's going to be the case. But if they say that, there is another option on the table for basketball coming back to the city of Seattle.
And that's not us raising those concerns. That was a report by my ESPN colleague, Jackie McMullen, on the Bill Simmons podcast, talking about concerns about that within the league. So it is a thing that's out there. And you know, Chris Hansen's right to point out that the trend is away from NHL and NBA teams sharing arenas towards NBA teams building their own arenas. And, you know, that's often in markets bigger than Seattle, but, you know, it's certainly a realistic possibility. I think that, you know, it would be better off to have an NBA team playing separately from the NHL team.
Where has that been the trend at? Where are the places that they're building separate? He mentioned Steve Ballmer, who obviously does not have his arena yet, but is planning on it.
Yeah, it's going to happen now at this point. Like, they've cleared out the obstacles.
But the Lakers are also still playing in the same arena as the Kings, right?
Correct.
So I don't know if that's exactly a perfect comparison.
Yeah, it's not. But Golden State building, you know, the Warriors building their own arena, that there was no interest in hockey there. The other thing about what Ballmer's doing
is that...
Was there a
hockey team already?
No, I mean, the Sharks are the Bay Area's team. If you want to talk about places where there are two teams playing in separate arenas, I believe that's the case in Minnesota, Phoenix. I mean, I can, you know, think longer about the list, but I don't know it off the top of my head. But, I mean, the other thing is that, you know, Steve Ballmer has talked about what you can do to make it a more intimate viewing experience with basketball if you don't have to account for the larger hockey rink. And I think that's a big factor as well. I mean, that's part of why Key Arena is, you know, good a place to watch the game from the 200 level as it was, is because of the fact that it was specifically designed to not allow the NHL to come, because the Ackerleys at that point did not want the competition, which is
anti-NHL.
Amusing, of course, that, you know, some of the Ackerley kids ended up as part of the ownership group of NHL Seattle. But
so you could literally build the seats closer to the floor for an NBA arena than you can if you have to accommodate for a larger hockey rink.
Oh, substantially so. Yeah.
Substantially.
It changes the sight lines in a huge way. Yeah.
I don't think that I've ever been to an arena, because I mean, I've been to the Rose Garden and to Key Arena, and I think that's it as far as NBA arenas.
The Moda Center is built for hockey. It's different from Key Arena in that standpoint.
And when it feels different, the it's more just like the angle in Portland is a different angle. Like, there's less looking straight down on the action than it is like a steadier incline.
Yeah, I mean, the end zones are built very deep, and it's like not as sharp of an angle as you have at Key Arena. Now, that's partially because of the fact that they just had more land to build on. The Moda Center has a way bigger footprint than Key Arena did. But it's also because of the fact that it is set up for hockey in a different way than Key Arena was. Whereas when the T-Birds played there, they, you know, basically there was no seating on one end of the ice, because you went up direct, the rink went directly up to, like, you know, row 15 for a Sonics game.
That's very interesting. No, I think that's an important point that Chris Hansen's making. And again, I think the most important thing is options, which is leaving no window open for the NBA to reject Seattle for any reason.
Exactly.
the opportunity has to be there in Seattle, no matter what the NBA is looking for. And if they're saying it has to be an NBA-only arena, there has to be an option for that. And if it's not going to be Climate Pledge Arena, then great. We're much less biased than Chris Hansen is, and the goal was 100% focus just on basketball. You know, to be clear, Chris Hansen wants an NBA team, and he wants to own the arena for it. So there's a little bit of a difference there, but the goal is still 100% basketball in Seattle, no matter what the fuck the arena is. Whether you're on top of the ice or on top of the court or not, it doesn't matter as long as people are playing basketball in the city of Seattle. And I think having options is the most important thing. Also, it's pretty funny Chris Hansen being like, just explaining how his experience is not the same as ours, being like, no matter what happens, I will be there courtside. Just like, yeah, yeah. I mean, like, I might be able to afford to go to 10 games.
Well, a couple other takeaways from that. We mentioned uncertainty about what the bidding process might look like when and if the NBA decides to expand. And that came up as something that remains unknown with the possibility of set price or open bidding. Chris Hansen said he's capable of being the controlling owner of a team, which would require a minimum 15% share. But, you know, depending on whether it was another group that ended up buying, you know, winning that process, or, you know, being part of a group was okay with being a minority investor, or, you know, a scenario where it's just partnering in terms of them providing the land for the arena and, you know, somebody else getting the team. I mean, there's a variety of ways that could look. So, and then lastly, Chris Hansen reiterated their desire for the street vacation of the Occidental Alley, which is necessary for the project to be shovel ready, but emphasize that they're not going to burden the city with it until it's necessary, until that time becomes right.
Sure. And that totally makes sense. And I think we've always felt like if the team is there, the NBA or the if an NBA team is there, that the city council will vote for that street vacation.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that thought predates the city's participation in the renovation of Climate Pledge Arena. So, you know, exactly what it looks like remains to be seen, but it's a different equation if you're going there with, you know, a team on the line.
Did Chris Hansen mention in this interview, did it feel like there is any sort of behind the scenes information or anything that he's seeing, conversations that are happening, that anything is moving on the league level at this point? Or is this mostly just chatter happening within Seattle right now?
You know, I think that there was, as you can sort of tell from the way we've had, you know, these updates on the podcast, there was a lot of steam and a lot of momentum in December, and there has not been as much of it since then as the NBA works to deal with the pandemic and, you know, figure out the All-Star game and trying to hold that. So, you know, those topics, I think, are their primary focus right now, not expansion.
Okay, that makes sense.
But we will, of course, continue to monitor this situation as updates warrant. Let's move on to the Sounders, because we have some positive news after last week's update. MLS and its Players Association agreed to a third new collective bargaining agreement in the past 12 months, which added 2 years to the term through 2027 in exchange for concessions on free agency starting in 2026. As long rumored, MLS is adding an under-22 player initiative that is expected to allow teams to pay unlimited transfer fees for up to 3 young players, though details on that are still TBA. And the salary cap under this deal will remain flat from where it was last year in 2020 through 2022. Some other logistical news: CONCACAF Champions League planning an expansion to 50 teams in 2023, with 20 North American teams playing a group stage for 11 spots in the 16-team knockout round. Unclear how MLS teams will qualify for group stage, but certainly many more opportunities for the Sounders to be a part of that CONCACAF Champions League when that happens in a couple years here. And then lastly, Jordan Morris and Swansea City take on Man City in the fifth round of the FA Cup Wednesday morning at 9:30 a.m. Pacific on ESPN+. Which is to say, most likely after you've already listened to this podcast, which is coming out early Wednesday morning. On the Oil Rain front, the Rain announced a partnership with Starbucks, who will be presenting partner of the Rain's Legends campaign, recognizing local female leaders before each match. Sounds like Zulily will not be back as their kit sponsors. There was a groundswell on the Talking Taco Time Twitter for Taco Time Northwest to step up and sponsor the Rain jerseys.
All right, Starbucks loves partnering with teams right before they move.
Oh, no. No. That's funny because it's real. Some more updates on the Seattle Storm. Hours after Crystal Langhorn announced her retirement on Monday, the Storm added veteran forward Candace Dupree as a free agent. The 15-year vet is joining her fourth team after being drafted by the Chicago Sky, playing for Phoenix for seven seasons, including her only WNBA championship, and the last four seasons with the Indiana Fever. Dupree is a seven-time All-Star, including the last time the game was played in 2019, and she had a media availability on Monday. It was the first media availability since the championship, basically, that the Storm have had, and talked about, you know, that it was an easy choice once the Storm showed interest because the money was pretty good and it was a chance for her to win late in her career. And she put it, quote, go out with a bang. So according to Derek James of the Next, it's a 1-year deal for $170,000 for Dupree. That gives the Storm $143,000 in cap space at the moment, which includes their core qualifying offer for Natasha Howard, but not free agent Sue Bird, who is committed to come back. And my ESPN colleague Michelle Vopel reported what was willing to take less money depending on what the Storm needs, and then restricted free agent Sammy Whitcomb. So certainly some more developments to come as we figure out what's going to happen with those three remaining key free agents for the Storm.
And what does this mean for the Storm roster heading into the next season?
I mean, the big interesting thing is, and I asked Candace Dupree about this, is she's a power forward.
I've got access. It's fine.
Singing out with Ray Montgomery, talking to Candace Dupree.
Look, I just walked into Little Woody's, and every time I walk in, Marcus says, Kevin!
Very infrequent. Very infrequent. Candace Dupree is a power forward by trade. Brianna Stewart, also a power forward by trade. The Storm has multiple players at center. We'll see what's going to happen with Natasha Howard at that position. One of the ways that they could try to replace Alicia Clark at small forward with her departure is to move Stewie out to the wing. I mean, this is something...
Whoa.
Yeah, it's something they talked about in 2018 when they first added Natasha Howard, because Crystal Langhorn at that point was still established as the starting center, and the thought was they might play all three of those players together. Then, you know, it turned out that it just kind of worked better with the smaller lineup that ended up winning the two championships with Clark at small forward and Natasha Howard at center. But Stewie is right now with her club team, UMMC at Katerinburg. She's starting at small forward for that team because they have such a deep front court with WNBA All-Star Jonquel Jones and the 2019 Finals MVP Emma Mieseman. So it's not something that's out of her wheelhouse.
Now, how do you feel about this? As somebody who thinks that Jeff Green is a center, how do you feel about Stewie starting at small forward?
It's not my favorite situation in the world, but also if you like look at the list of free agents that were left, not a lot of great options at small forward. So I can see why they would have settled on Candace Dupree, who's a much, you know, more accomplished WNBA player than any of those options would have been.
Stewie can stretch the floor. That doesn't matter to you. Is it about having speed at small forward? Why is it not your favorite thing?
Because you still have more shooting when you play smaller lineups and more quickness. One of the things that's going to be interesting that I mentioned on Twitter is Candace Dupree has basically never shot threes except for one. She had one season where she shot well. She shot like 39%. And this was like 2009. It was a long time ago. And then she stopped ever shooting threes. When she made three last year, it was her most in a season since then. So Crystal Langhorn, a couple of years ago, the Storm basically encouraged her to stretch her range out from, she was kind of that same kind of 17, 18 foot jump shooter, pick and pop player, to shooting threes instead. And she made a career high 3-pointer. So it'll be interesting to see if they do that with Dupree too. But certainly if you got a traditional small forward, there would be a better floor spacer, I think, in that spot. So
you can't help yourself.
Look, the smaller the better.
You would start Stewie at center if you could.
I would not go that far. I would definitely not go that far. All right, this is the first time in a long time we've had this on our notes. UW softball is back.
There we go. Finally, some good news.
The Huskies will begin the season this weekend in the UNLV tournament, where they will face Dixie State, Southern Utah, and the host Running Rebels in five games Friday through Sunday. They begin the season ranked second in the ESPN.com USA Softball Top 25, receiving one first place vote. The other 19 went to UCLA, still the defending champion, dating back to 2009 when they beat the Huskies in the semifinals.
Not 2009.
Sorry, 2009 would be too long. Canis DeBrie was
shooting threes. UCLA's been winning championships since. But bring it on, Dixie State. You got nothing.
I feel like they do. In fact, they have very little going on against the Huskies. They're easing into the schedule, I think, with this one. You know, it was not easy into the schedule.
Oh, God.
UW women's basketball, which suffered a 63-54 loss at home last Friday versus USC in a game where they took the lead to the fourth quarter, but outscored 24-14 in the final period. And then Sunday against number 5 UCLA, lost 84-50 in a game where they were never competitive. Does it get much easier this weekend as they travel to Arizona on Friday, play at Arizona State, and then Sunday at number 10 Arizona, which is coming off a big win against number 11 Oregon on Monday night in a showdown. Adia Barnes and former UW assistant Adia Barnes, as well as Storm legend and UW transfer Ari McDonald, have the Wildcats in the top 10 and like a legit Final Four contender at this point. Wasn't much better for UW men's basketball, which traveled to play the Oregon schools last weekend, suffered a 91-71 loss Thursday at Oregon State. That was the 20-point margin was the Beavers' biggest against a Division I opponent this season. Had been 12 points versus UTSA. Huskies shot just 5 of 20 from 3 in that game, despite 22 points off the bench from Marcus Sahonis. The loss dropped them 15 spots in the KenPom rankings.
There's 15 spots to drop. Can we convert this arena that houses the two basketball teams into a hockey arena? Like, come on.
It's too small. It's too small. On Saturday was an 86-74 loss at Oregon for the Huskies, who got strong games from Sahonis again and then Quade Green, but the Huskies got crushed on the glass by Oregon in this one.
The sport of hockey has rejected the University of Washington.
They move. You know who's starring in hockey, by the way? A guy named Ty Pelton Bice for Wisconsin.
Pelton Bice.
Yeah, we out here, Peltons.
That out by Googling yourself, of course.
Well, don't worry about it. Don't worry about how I know that information. I just know it. It's an unorthodox three-game week for the Huskies upcoming, as they will play host USC on Thursday, UCLA on Saturday, and then on Monday play at Washington State. And a game that's scheduled like that to fit in the extended 20-game conference schedule.
Unorthodox is the most generous way of describing that week. It is a harrowing three-game week for Husky basketball. It is a painful three-game week for Husky basketball. I tuned into this Oregon State game for a bit.
Did you?
And I feel like the only way to approach Husky basketball is as if it's a movie that is so bad it's funny. And if that's how you view Husky basketball, like every time they commit a hilarious turnover, it's fun. All of a sudden, if you go into the expectation or the goal of them winning, that's bad, right? You're not going to see an Oscar performance here. But if you want it to be so bad that it's hilarious, that's okay.
As I used to say with the Sonics, if you're going to be bad, be historically bad.
But that's not even true. Like, yes, for the Sonics, because they get a draft pick, all you get is more bad.
It's not ideal.
Additional badness.
I don't know if you saw this, by the way, that Mike Varela,
Russell Wilson
Seattle
is getting
Times,
traded, plus the basketball team is terrible.
Well,
plus it's going to snow for like 10 fucking days. What else have you got, February?
You're down on snow?
No, I'm pretty excited about the snow.
Yeah, I mean, Jan's very upset about snow because she can't get up to her house to check her mail and is concerned about that. But I'm like, it's a pandemic. I don't need to go anywhere. Let it snow. It's not like I'm going to miss my flight to Charleston.
God damn it. You had to bring up Charleston too.
Oh, no. The real rough pod for Tristan. Anyways, Mike Varell did an interview with Jen Cohen, the UW athletic director, where she gave her support for Mike Hopkins. It's a little weird that there's so much like fire Mike Hopkins talk when he is 2 years removed from winning Pac-12 Coach of the Year in back-to-back years in his first 2 years as head coach. Like, man, did that honeymoon period end quickly.
It's just, the thing is, if there was something on the horizon, if there right. was, we have a crystal ball, we can see into the future, right? There's no turning this around. And I think that's the
eventually it's going to turn around, but it's not going to happen quickly.
Like, eventually everything is going to, I mean, right? Like with glacial drift, all things will turn around. You know what I mean? Like that's not a prediction.
Oh man, I can't wait for Ben to make one of his motivational quotes or like posters with UW men's basketball, glacial drift, everything will turn around.
We can see what's on the horizon here. And I think that's why people are down. There's not like a great recruiting class coming. It doesn't feel like there's progress or steam toward even, you know, signing the best players out of the area. So I think that's the bigger issue, is the support for firing Mike Hopkins is about both a combination of the team being god awful right now, completely uncompetitive and hilariously uncompetitive, but also looking ahead and recognizing that it's not like it's going to be better next year. It's not, I'd be very shocked if it was better the year after that, right? Like Mike Hopkins will not be the head coach in the University of Washington the next time they make the NCAA tournament. And I don't feel like that's a bold prediction.
It is not. No, it would not qualify as a bold prediction. Is the ombudsman of the bold predictions. I would reject that summarily. As you mentioned about this harrowing week, the Huskies own three so far against the teams they face. USC and UCLA come to Seattle tied for first in the Pac-12 with 9-2 records after the Trojans won head-to-head on Saturday night. The Cougars followed up their win at Heck Ed a couple weeks ago with an impressive win in Eugene, their first ever at Matt Knight Arena since that opened, before losing a heartbreaker 68-66 Saturday in Corvallis. And now let's remember a happier time when there was hope on the horizon for UW basketball. Back in 2003-04, that time they traveled to LA, beating USC 93-82 before seeing their five-game winning streak snapped by UCLA 80-75. The 2003-04 Trojans feature the Stewart twins, which I know, again, the younger listener who doesn't know how great Nate Robinson was also probably doesn't remember how much the Stewart twins, his teammates at Rainier Beach,
Roderick and Lodrick, and then eventually Hakeem.
Yes. He was not one of the twins. It was not as hyped as it turned out. They did not, I would say, live up to that hype, although I can't remember which of them. One of them transferred to Kansas and I think won a national championship. The Trojans also had future Sonic Desmond Farmer, who went for 31 points on 10 of 20 shooting in that game. UW had five players in double figures and forced 21 USC turnovers. This UCLA team, it was Ben Howland's first year in Westwood, and they had, as usual, a lot of talent. One and done Trevor Ariza, longtime NBA journeyman Ryan Hollins, and two other guys who played briefly in the league in Cedric Bozeman and leading scorer DeJon Thompson. But they entered this game on a six-game losing streak before leading by seven at halftime and shooting 62.5% in the second half to hold off a Brian and Roy-led comeback effort. Mike Jensen had a three to tie in the final 20 seconds that he airballed. Roy's 30 points were a new career high, and he grabbed 9 boards in the loss.
I'm trying to think if I remember this game. Where did we watch that UCLA game?
I don't remember anything about either of these games.
Let's remember 2003, 2004.
Again, last week we had some great memories. We'll get some more memories going forward, but these ones I do not remember.
We need Katie here to not remember these games with us.
Oh, wow.
Because if you and I don't remember it, there's no way Katie remembers it.
The more people who can't remember, the better.
I got nothing else. I mean, the UCLA team, I mean, that was eventually the Ben Howland team. And maybe that wasn't exactly the makeup of it, because Trevor Ariza
Not at all the makeup of it.
Ben Howland definitely starting to build some things there in the same way that Lorenzo was.
I do remember the Huskies playing UCLA because they played them in the Pac-12 tournament, but we will get to that.
When did you invent the term Howland?
Oh, not until well after that. Twitter existed by the time I invented, or I was on Twitter by the time I invented that. So way after.
All right.
At that point, it might have seemed, it might not have seemed so notable, or, you know, we hadn't seen it 1,000 times like we eventually did.
The Howland was in its neophyte stages.
Oh, shouts to Gus Johnson. Gus Johnson. So, shouts to Clyde Frazier, I should say.
Every time, that's neophyte. That's going to be the shouts to Clyde Frazier.
Of course. Okay. He's famous for saying the word neophyte. UW football news. Some rare post-signing day woofs from Jimmy Lake the last week because of a couple of transfers, both from the state of Texas. First, Texas Tech wide receiver Jalen Polk, who announced his transfer last Wednesday. He had 28 catches for 264 yards and 2 touchdowns during his true freshman season with the Red Raiders, which consisted of 10 games. Caught 28 of 31 targets, 91%, for 8.5 yards per target and 0.35 expected points added per play. Impressive catch rate, but the yards per target actually would have ranked last among Husky receivers with at least 10 targets, so not a lot of big plays in there. Polk was a consensus 3-star recruit coming out of Lufkin, Texas, who have 4 full years of eligibility at UW, and followed his friend Caleb Berry, who committed to UW as a running back, was kind of involved in bringing him here.
This is awesome. Let's bring on some transfers. I mean, I was talking to you about what makes a good college basketball team in the year 2021, and you said the only way to be a good college basketball team is by having transfers. And if UW can lower some of their transfer restrictions that they have, and it feels like Jimmy's been able to, he's been able to push upper campus, so to say, as far as bringing in these transfers for the football team just a little bit here.
And this may also just be them being more aggressive with transfers, because it's like the restrictions were probably more about an issue with the grad transfers, which they have managed at the quarterback position the last 2 years, than they were undergraduate transfers per se. But you know, it's also becoming just a bigger part of the sport with the transfer portal and fewer restrictions on transfers. Apparently, it sounds like all transfers will be automatically eligible next year because of the fact that, you know, it's a pandemic.
Okay, so Polk will be able to play immediately next year.
That's the understanding. And then that was followed Tuesday by an announced transfer from Texas A&M edge rusher Jeremiah Martin. San Bernardino, California native was a 4-star recruit who considered the Huskies before choosing the Aggies. He was not especially productive as a pass rusher at Texas A&M, recording 0 sacks and 3 tackles for a loss in 32 career games across 3 seasons, primarily contributing on special teams. Because this year didn't count as a year of eligibility, much like with Polk, he will have 3 years to play 2 at UW.
I mean, he's going to be old by the time he's a senior, right? Like, he's going to be a man amongst boys by the time he's a senior. That'll be his 6th year if he
potentially if he were to redshirt. Yeah. I mean,
how much like the weekend meme is the transfer portal? When you enter the transfer portal,
that's actually good. That's the best transfer portal reference I've heard, I think. I'm notoriously anti people saying that players have entered the transfer portal. You just put your name in there. That's all you do. It's not like on Star Trek. You don't enter the transfer portal and then you just automatically
go from.
Tell us
more about Star Trek, Kevin Pelton.
Oh no.
I feel like you're versed in this. You're out here referencing Star Trek. So tell us a little bit more.
But there's a portal.
Not, how do you know? You don't know if there's a portal.
I'm pretty sure there's a portal.
I've seen the one bit of Star Trek I've ever seen is I fell asleep one time and my TV was on. I was probably watching like a Frasier rerun or something. And my TV was on KCTS, I think. And I woke up and Scott Bakula, right? He was on a Star Trek. I think it was Deep Space Nine. Scott Bakula was on
Star Trek Quantum Leap.
And I was like, what the fuck is happening? That's every bit of Star Trek that I've ever watched.
Maybe this is a difference because of the fact that like the 3 years difference between us makes a big difference, because I remember watching a lot of Star Trek as a kid before.
Really?
Yeah. Like it was on all the time. There wasn't a lot on in, I don't know, 1989 or 90 or whenever this was. Like, I definitely have a vivid memory of watching the Evil Spock episode.
You've never once talked to me. I'm learning something new about you here on this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Never once mentioned Star Trek to me before.
Like, I don't know that I could get into a lot of specifics here, but I'm aware of what's going on in Star Trek.
All right.
Which apparently is more than I could say for you.
I mean, I know the principles.
Do you?
Yeah, we've got Reading Rainbow. And
you've got Kimi Takei's uncle.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. I know him as David Locke's uncle-in-law. Yes. Or whatever. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Should we have this Russell Wilson conversation? Or Russell Westbrook conversation? It'd be a little different in tone, but we can have that too.
Well, do you want to run through kind of everything that's happened around Russell Wilson? Because I think the most incredible thing is we see a tweet from Jason Lockenfora. And you're thinking to yourself, how much do I trust this one random tweet from Jason Lockenfora? And then it was like, Russell Wilson on a random Tuesday is on like a media blitz. He's everywhere all of a sudden. Talking about his feelings around the Seahawks, couching them quite a bit, but it's a little bit like, why right now? Like, where is this coming from? And you're saying that he was being interviewed because of this GQ Modern Lovers feature. That's why he was on the Dan Patrick show.
That's why the timing was, yes. But I don't think it's like, look, if Russell Wilson wanted to deliver this message, he could have done it at any point he wanted. So, you know, I don't think that was necessarily at issue. All right, so let's start with that Jason Lockenfora tweet on Monday night. I'm hearing Russell Wilson's camp has grown increasingly frustrated by the Seahawks' inability to protect the 8-time Pro Bowler. He has been sacked 394 times in 9 seasons, which we later learned is the most ever for a player through their first 9 seasons. This situation warrants serious monitoring. So, then Wilson, Tuesday morning, goes on the Dan Patrick show. He's asked, we'll go through a series of questions and answers here. Asked by Patrick about whether he had any say in the Seahawks roster moves. I want to be able to be involved, because at the end of the day, it's your legacy. It's your team's legacy. It's the guys you get to go into the huddle with. And at the end of the day, those guys you've got to trust. And then Patrick follows up and says, you didn't answer whether you have any involvement. And he says, not as much. And then Patrick asks, do you want to be involved? Yeah, I think it helps to be involved more. I think that dialogue should happen more often, in my opinion. So then Dan Patrick asks him about that sack stat. Why is he sacked so frequently? Wilson answers, I think that sometimes you hold on to it a little bit just because you're looking for that play and you find it. But also so many of those times it turns into touchdowns too. But you never want to be sacked that many times. 400 times basically is way too many. 400 too many. So I think that's a big thing that we've got to fix. That's got to be fixed and has to be at the end of the day because my goal is to play 10 to 15 more years. He said a few other things and then also mentioned this. You watched the game the other night. The difference in that game was Tom was taking shots, that Brady, of course, down the field and getting the ball to his guys, but he wasn't touched really. I think he got sacked one time in the game early on. And then also said, we've got to get better up front before praising Dwayne Brown and his addition. Additionally, Patrick asked him about reports that teams are calling the Seahawks about his availability. The reports have also indicated that they've been rebuffed in those. He said, I'm not sure how long I'll play in Seattle. Hopefully it's going to be forever, but things change, obviously, along the way. So then after this Dan Patrick show appearance, Wilson did media availability with members of the local media. He was asked by Greg Bell of the News Tribune if he's frustrated with the Seahawks. Said, I'm frustrated getting hit too much. I'm frustrated with that part of it. At the end of the day, you want to win. He did notably in that discussion praise the hiring of offensive coordinator Shane Waldron, saying, I think Shane's going to be a great coach. I think he's got great knowledge of the game. And then later Tuesday, short-lived Seahawks wide receiver Brandon Marshall, really, he poured gasoline on the fire, I'd say, on First Things First on FS1, saying he believes that Wilson is, quote, trying to find a way to move on in a classy way. He said that the Seahawks have only drafted one offensive lineman during Wilson's tenure, which I assume means in the first round, that being Jermaine Ifedi. Said that when he was with the Seahawks in 2018, we had no quick game, quote unquote, and indicated that in his observation, Pete Carroll had heavy influence on the Seahawks' offensive philosophy.
Thanks, Brandon Marshall.
So that's where we stand. That's what's happened in the last 48 hours, give or take here. Who knows what the rest of the week might bring?
You know, there's obviously something to this. It's so much more than the Jason Lockenfort tweet. There's clearly some frustration between Russell Wilson and the Seahawks. And there's some frustration between all of us and the Seahawks. Because this, like...
There's not frustration between all of us and the Seahawks. Feels like a lot of people online are taking the Seahawks side.
There's frustration between all of us here on this podcast and the Seahawks. Like, Russell Wilson is making valid points throughout this. And I think the question is, how serious are these complaints by Russell Wilson? I mean, the reality is, like, he's probably not going to be traded this offseason. Russell Wilson is almost certainly going to be a Seahawk heading into next year. Correct. Like, it would take an extraordinarily dramatic turn of events for him not to be a Seahawk next year. And also, this week, or the couple days after the Super Bowl 2021, we're not going to remember come September 2021. So,
I don't know if I agree with that necessarily.
It's laying a groundwork for future frustration, right? But it's more like, if things are going well, Russell Wilson isn't going to be frustrated. Nobody's going to be frustrated. If Shane Waldron works out as well as we would like him to, nobody's going to be frustrated. I think what it is it's putting himself in a position where, if he eventually wants to be extraordinarily frustrated with the Seahawks, wants to request a trade or whatever, then he's already had the conversation. It's not going to come out of nowhere. But it's a bit of putting pressure on them to go out and find offensive linemen. And I think that's something that this is not an unreasonable request for Russell Wilson to make, because the Seahawks have, in Pete Carroll's tenure, I don't even know what I would say that they value. That's the thing, is like, you can't look at it and be like, they value this in the draft, aside from run-stuffing defensive linemen.
Oh, I did some research on this.
Hello.
Because, like, a lot of members of the Seattle media pointed out the number of offensive linemen that the Seahawks have drafted.
Yes.
But that's kind of a meaningless stat, because there's a big difference between drafting someone in the seventh round and drafting someone in the first round. What you really need to talk about is the amount of draft capital you invest by position. So, of course, I did some R here and worked out the percentage of each team's draft capital that they have spent by position during the Russell Wilson era since he was drafted in 2012.
Okay.
And the Seahawks rank, they're slightly below average. Or no, actually, they're slightly below average in terms of the investment in the offensive line in the draft. They're 20th. And that may understand it a little bit, because they did draft Russell Okung. They spent a ton of draft capital on offensive line the couple of seasons before Russell Wilson
traded, I think, a second round pick for Dwayne Brown as well.
Right, which this wouldn't factor in there. But it's something that makes me think this goes beyond just offensive line. I was curious, if you go split it into offense and defense overall, the Seahawks rank 22nd in draft capital invested on offense, and they only rank above average in one position group on offense. Do you care to guess which position group that is?
Running back.
Damn right, they are third in most draft capital invested on running backs.
Oh my God.
Since 2012.
Well, they've gotten definitely so little out of it, too. That's the wild thing. Their most successful running backs that they've drafted since 2012, the most successful running backs not drafted that they've brought to the team since 2012 was undrafted rookie free agent Thomas Rawls and seventh round draft pick Chris Carson. They're bad at drafting running backs, which they are spending a lot of capital on.
The position they've spent by far the most capital on is defensive lineman. Mm-hmm. As a percentage of total draft capital expended, they rank third at that position since 2012. The other interesting note, by the way,
and you don't differentiate run stuffing versus pass rushing because they're interested in the least important aspect of fucking defensive line.
I mean, the thing is, like, their defensive line isn't even that good. Like, for all the draft capital they've expended on, I mean, obviously the Dowell pick did not yield any dividends for reasons that didn't necessarily have to do with his ability on the field. It is surprising they're dead last in draft capital expended since 2012 at defensive back. That was interesting.
Yeah, they're actually the worst team at drafting ever. Like, you're talking about understanding value in the draft totally wrong. They're putting value into positions completely wrong for how they should be putting value into positions. And they also have just missed. You know, I think there was that tweet that was out there about the Buccaneers, right? And it was looking at, say, their last four drafts and how many of the picks in early rounds that they've hit on during that time period. It's not comparable to the Seahawks. You know, like, the Buccaneers had a team that just needed a quarterback or whatever. Right? Like, they have a great defense, you know?
And
across the board.
Once upon a time, the Seahawks drafted that well. And they, I mean, like, it's
once
the
upon
drafting
a time
part of it's kind of random.
2 years. But it's also about understanding where value exists.
Yes. And if it is going to be random, then you should at least set yourself up to have the best chances of success by drafting the right positions.
The thing that you could do, you know, we talked about glacial drift or whatever, right? The thing that you could do as an NFL team to constantly be getting an edge over everybody else is drafting a lot of players and drafting at the right positions. These are two things that are extraordinarily simple to do, really. It's not hard to get a lot of draft picks as an NFL team. It really just requires caring about getting a lot of draft picks. And even if you trade first-round picks for Jamal Adams, you can still find ways into getting a number of draft picks. And what you can do to get an added edge over everybody else in the draft is be constantly drafting players in the most important positions to winning games and be drafting a lot of players. The Seahawks sort of have one of those pieces right, and they massively have the other piece wrong. But the other part of it is that the places that they're trying to that they're putting effort and value towards, they're not even good at doing.
Right.
They're not good at finding defensive linemen. You know, like, I don't know if I could even tell you what the Seahawks are good at finding necessarily in the draft at this point, because I don't think that there is a position that they're good at finding players. They, you know, they've come up with some hits at various different times at different positions, right? Shaquille Griffin, DK Metcalf, right? Those players were good draft picks, but it doesn't feel like it's repeatable in any way.
Which, again, the evidence suggests none of it is repeatable. It's all just completely, it's such a small sample size that it's all completely random.
But there's no good process in what they're doing. They wasted a fucking first round pick on a running back. They wasted a first round pick on a run stuffing defensive lineman. They have wasted Russell Wilson's prime by doing everything wrong. How they approach free agency is wrong. The Seahawks do everything wrong. Russell Wilson should be pissed. He is basically the only good thing they've done in the last decade.
Well, the last decade does include the Super Bowl victory. It does include them adding Michael Bennett and Cliff Avril in free agency. I don't know if I would extend it that far. But yeah, I mean, Russell Wilson's the reason this is a consistent playoff team. It's certainly not Pete Carroll's coaching. I mean, you know, as much as I respect what he does in terms of managing a locker room and everything like that. So, like, if it eventually does come to a point where it's Russell Wilson versus the organization, like, the correct choice is clear. Russell Wilson is the most important member of the organization. But
this is the frustrating thing. We know who's going to win this. If there is a power struggle between Russell Wilson and the organization, Pete Carroll is more important to the Seahawks organization internally than Russell Wilson is. He holds all the power. Russell Wilson is out there doing a media blitz because he doesn't hold the power. This is what Russell Wilson
about it. You're thinking about it at the John Schneider level. You should not be thinking about it at the John Schneider level. You should be thinking about it at the Jody Allen and Burt Colley level. Because if it eventually does come to that, those are the people who are going to make the decision, not John Schneider.
I think there is a very good chance that those decision makers also see eye to eye with Pete Carroll more than they do with Russell Wilson. That's the respect that Pete Carroll has earned in the front office.
They're very quiet. I don't think that we can assume that.
Pete Carroll has not won with Russell Wilson in the NFL.
Russell Wilson?
What?
He actually has won quite a bit with Russell Wilson.
I said Pete Carroll has not won without Russell Wilson.
Yeah, you said with.
In the NFL, Pete Carroll has needed Russell Wilson to win games.
Again, we don't need to make the case here. I think we're all in agreement on this one.
They should be doing everything that they can do to make Russell Wilson's life better. And the unfortunate thing is
one of the things they could have done to make Russell Wilson's life better is to sign Antonio Brown. I don't know that you think they should have done that. I got to think that wasn't not part of it. Seeing Antonio Brown win the Super Bowl with Tom Brady. I don't think that was not part of it. Like, he mentioned kind of casually during the Dan Patrick show, the number of weapons that Tampa Bay had, and he didn't like go out of his way to highlight Antonio Brown, but didn't go out of his way to not highlight Antonio Brown.
You know, I was thinking about, there is a quote about legacy or whatever. And I feel like this idea that there are good teams out there that are just waiting for Russell Wilson. And I'm not sure how factually correct that is, that there are situations like the Buccaneers that are just sitting and waiting for a player like Russell Wilson. I think the Buccaneers also got maybe extraordinarily lucky at various points throughout the year. But like, it takes a combination of being bad for a pretty long time and developing the talent that they've had. It also takes hitting on basically every single defensive pick and being able to build up some of those offensive weapons during that time period. I just don't know. You know, the Chicago Bears don't have the fucking offense waiting for a quarterback like the Buccaneers had. Like, I think they were a one out of one situation, and people are treating it like it's a one out of many situation. And there are other situations that the talent around him could be better than the Seahawks, but like, it's not the Buccaneers season that they had in 2020, 2021 is an outlier.
Sure. I mean, I think that you would look at teams like the Dolphins and the Colts as teams that are well built, you know, to support a better quarterback than they currently have, or at least, currently have, because Philip Rivers is retired.
Sure. There are definitely teams like that, right? But it's not as common of a situation as it feels.
And I think it's more Russell Wilson trying to do the Aaron Rodgers thing of, let's make sure that you surround me with the weapons that I need, than to say I'm actually want to leave right now. I think that's pretty unlikely.
I don't think an offensive line can be fixed in a year, though. I don't think
the Seahawks are that far away from a competent offensive line. We saw during the first half of last season, the offensive line played at a high enough level for them to be as good offensively as they were. And injuries were a factor in that in the second half of the season. I mean, you look at left guard as a position that they definitely can stand to upgrade, where they rotated Mike Iupati and Simmons there. But, you know, Jordan Simmons there. But are you going to find a dramatically better center than Ethan Posick? And the other three spots are pretty well set, at least for next season.
So. I mean, I hope that that's the case, but part of me feels like maybe they're fully committed to players that aren't actually that good, you know, where it's like the players who are entrenched are not players who make up a top 10 offensive line.
I mean,
and you have a severely aging Dwayne Brown.
Sure. And they don't really have the resources to do a lot. But again, I think for the first half of last season, this was an above average pass blocking offensive line. And that changed in the second half of last season.
What happened, though? Did it become a worse offensive line because of Pete Carroll's fixing the offense?
I think that was probably a factor in it.
Did the line just play worse?
Well, they had, again, Brandon Schell got injured, and the drop-off from Brandon Schell to Cedric Ogbuehi and Chad Wheeler, who has now been released after his domestic violence charge, it was pretty dramatic. And then Schell was back for the playoff game, but I don't know if he was 100% at that point. He, you know, obviously wasn't as effective as he was at the start of the season.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I hope is that the line is close and that Shane Waldron's offense – coming in will change things. I mean, you know, it's putting pressure on Pete Carroll on behalf of Russell Wilson. And I think it's something that, again, it worked for Rodgers, but like,
well, we don't know yet whether it worked for Rodgers.
It worked. I mean, Aaron Rodgers has won regular season. He won a fucking MVP. It worked for Rodgers.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about changing. I didn't realize you meant changing the system. I thought you meant the pressure that he was putting on the Packers in his postseason press conference.
Who knows? Who knows if that's the case? But like, those things have worked for Aaron Rodgers. He also had an entrenched offensive line. You know, I don't know if
By the way, weirdly, you know who has spent less draft capital than any other team on offensive line?
Well, they have an older line that was already there, I feel like.
I don't know how many of those guys even were there, but they've spent less draft capital than any team on offensive line in the past nine drafts or eight drafts.
If you're in Wisconsin, they're just linemen.
Yeah, they just grow on trees there.
They play better in the state of Wisconsin somehow.
it's all the cheese and corn.
Those things worked for Aaron Rodgers, though, and
I don't know if there's a corn in Wisconsin.
That is Nebraska that you're thinking of.
I am aware of that.
I'm curious to see how it'll work for Russell Wilson, but like, you know, putting pressure on the organization, I think is this is all that's happening right now. Like, the people panic. Russell Wilson's not getting traded, and that's the piece that I think is getting a little bit lost in the mix here. Like, going anywhere.
It's good for page views to talk about Russell Wilson getting traded.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great for Brandon Marshall, right? Like, we're paying attention to Brandon Marshall in this show that otherwise we'd be paying no attention to whatsoever. So, like, I get why it's happening. I'm just saying that I think that there's a little bit more panic happening right now than needs to happen. This isn't Deshaun Watson requesting a trade.
Are we talking about Seahawks Twitter in February? Like, panicking more than it needs to? What?
Ultimately, I think it means very little. You know, I think this time period means very little. I think the reality is Pete Carroll and John Schneider are probably not going to do things all that differently than they've done things for the last decade. I think that they have a very specific way of viewing the world.
It's easy to just ask Russell Wilson his opinion and give him like some minor concessions. Like, that's not a lot to do, for God's sake.
I guess it sounds like he probably wasn't involved in the Shane Waldron hiring, but it seems like he was at least consulted with the idea.
I think they at least asked his opinion. I don't think it was a deciding factor, but I don't think that's the issue. I think, again, it goes back to Antonio Brown is most likely the precipitating.
You really think
conflict.
Antonio Brown is that big of a factor here? Antonio Brown, I mean, I guess he did play fairly well in the Super Bowl, but like, wasn't really a big part of the Buccaneers offense.
It seems like Russell Wilson was behind the Seahawks' interest in him. They pretty publicly cut ties with him before he signed with Tampa Bay, where he won the Super Bowl with Russell Wilson in attendance. I can see how Russell Wilson would construct a version of this where the Seahawks are the bad guys and prevented the team from advancing deeper by not pushing to sign Antonio Brown.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think it's just about Antonio Brown. I mean, he hasn't cited his wide receivers. He's cited the pass blocking, but I do think that's a factor.
Yeah, I mean, the Seahawks didn't have the eighth pick or whatever to draft Tristan Wirfs. Like, I just... There was no opportunity for them to get a player like that. And I think that's the unique scenario, again, that Tampa Bay was put in. Is like,
well, I mean, first off, they traded two first-round picks to get a premier player at safety. So I don't think we could say that, like, oh, they can't possibly get a player of that caliber. Like, they just chose to do it differently. It's like when people say they don't have time for something. You always have time for something. You chose to do something else.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose so, but like that's the issue here. That's what we're talking about, is that they keep spending capital on defense because they can't draft defensive players. They can't sign defensive players. They can't get a good defense no matter what. They have not been able to pair a good defense and a good offense together for a very long time at this point. And they keep trying, and it's not working. The only thing that is working in the organization is Russell Wilson and, you know, DK Metcalf in the offense in the first half of the season. And Pete Carroll corrected that. Like, this is a Pete Carroll issue.
Yep.
There's no answer. Like, you look at this and you're like, yeah, I don't want you to leave Russell Wilson, but you're right. You're not wrong about what's going on here. And I think, you know, you saw it in Los Angeles where, you know, they signed Andrew Whitfield and immediately
Andrew Whitworth.
They signed Andrew Whitworth and immediately the offense got significantly better. And, you know, the Seahawks went out and traded for Dwayne Brown, who is an anchor left tackle, I think is important, but it's hard to do things without an offensive line.
I mean, that's one of the takeaways from the Super Bowl is we had, you know, the MVP quarterback. We had an extremely creative pair of offensive minds in Eric Bieniemy and Andy Reid, and the inability to block Tampa Bay, they just couldn't figure out how to deal with throughout that game. Like, that's what determined the game, determined the Super Bowl. So, again, it makes sense that Russell Wilson, seeing all of these things, would be thinking the way he is right now.
He should. I mean, would you not look at that and your takeaway being that the tackles for the Kansas City Chiefs are the linchpins for what they're doing?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like I've constantly been here preaching the value of offensive line, and nobody's listening.
Somebody must be listening. The listener must be listening.
I feel like it really is ultimately all that matters.
Well, I don't agree with that, no.
I think a quarterback and an offensive line are more important than anything else. The problem is offensive line requires five very good players.
It is more challenging from that standpoint.
It's an incredibly hard thing to build, but we see it in college all the time. I mean, you see quarterbacks who are probably like B quarterbacks be excellent. I mean, we talked about this with regards to Trevor Lawrence, where it's like every highlight that you have Trevor Lawrence, he's just standing back there, has 25 minutes because Clemson's recruiting all of the best offensive linemen every single year. And of course it's easy for Trevor Lawrence to do things.
Because what you're saying is Pete Carroll should go back to college.
Yeah. You can stack the odds in your favor by a billion in college. Like, I mean, if you can be successful in college, I don't understand why you would ever leave. But look, Nick Saban has it right, folks.
Wow.
It's cheating. Like, it's not cheating, but like, you have it set up.
I mean, there probably is some cheating.
Oh, there's all sorts of cheating going on.
Who cares? But the rules are bad.
You have it set up so perfectly in your favor. There's no draft to give everybody else a competitive edge against you. There's no scheduling where, like, you have to play the hardest teams because you're good. You have it set up that if you're the best team, you continue to get better. College is obviously better. But, like, the Seahawks need to invest more capital in offensive line.
All right. Well, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.